You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time. Of all time. Of all time.
Of all time.
Of all time.
Of all time.
Of all time.
Of all time.
Of all time.
Of all time.
Of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
All right, everybody, you're listening to The Brian Callen Show. Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Go to audiblepodcast.com/BCS to download your free book.
And I'm with Sam Sheridan, who's an author. We're going to get into his book. Is your book that we are going to talk about, The Disaster Diaries, on Audible right now?
Yes, it is. The Audible book is available.
Oh, good. So you guys can download the book we're going to talk about, which is The Disaster Diaries. I've read it. I loved it. I'll remind people that Audible now has an application called WhisperSync. So if you're reading it on your Kindle, you can then, when you get in your car, it'll pick up where you left off and start.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, start speaking.
That's great. I mean, yeah, I gotta start doing that for like long runs and stuff like that.
It's the best, man.
And remember, go to audiblepodcast.com/BCS to get your free book today or tomorrow or next week or whenever.
I'm here with Sam Sheridan, and you have written A Fighter's Heart, A Fighter's Mind. We've talked a lot about it with Jay Moore. You talked to him on his podcast. Jay's a huge fan, as am I. And I read The Disaster Diaries, and it's how I learned to stop worrying and love the apocalypse. And what I found fascinating about this book, because I ended up reading a lot of your source material that you gave me, like The Science of Fear and it brings me to a point that I was going to talk about, which is that, you know, what you think is going to happen in an emergency very often is not what's going to happen. You are not going to rise to the occasion. You are going to sink to the level of your training, which is why they tell people to rehearse dialing 911. And it brings me to the senator who said, well, too bad that teacher didn't have an M4 on her when that guy came in and started shooting. And it's like, dude, you it's not enough to teach teachers to shoot a gun. You've got to inoculate them to the stress of combat. And that is something that takes a long time and doesn't always work with trained professionals.
Well, it's a complicated question. And to get into the gun control argument is a thorny issue. It can easily derail us. I mean, the shooter at Columbine exchanged shots with an armed deputy. You know what I mean?
Right.
And Virginia Tech had an armed SWAT team on campus. Mm. So, you know, it doesn't...
Did they really?
Yeah. It has its own huge...
But this kid locked himself in that building, and by the time
it's over before it starts. And again, I think, yes, it'd be great to have, you know, an armed response to active shooters, but I think that the lesson for us and for me was certainly, like, you know, owning a gun does not mean you can use it, and you really have to train and burn those muscle memory into your cognitive abilities before you can do it, and you won't do it.
Well, talk a little bit about that, because training changed for SWAT team, special forces soldiers and stuff like that. They learned that they couldn't just train them to shoot a gun. They had to inoculate them to stress, essentially.
Well, you know,
inoculate, guys, meaning not to be pejorative here, but, you know, in other words, they had to make them somewhat immune to the stress of combat, the loudness, the noise, the pain of getting shot, all the shock
the
of seeing your friend.
The adrenaline, all those chemicals, they have this huge effect on your perception, you know, on your perception of time, on your perception of yourself, on, you know, people have auditory exclusion, they can't hear gunshots, and you have to sort of become accustomed to those things to really function well in that environment, and that's a real trick. Grossman wrote a book, an earlier book called On Killing, where he did a lot of studies about training as comparison to kill rates in wars. And, you know, the gist of it is that when soldiers were shooting at paper targets, you know, just bullseyes, they had very low kill rates. They didn't kill very well. And as soon as they started shooting at silhouettes, at humans, things that look like people, and the more realistic that simulation became, their kill rates went up. So you have to, in order to kill somebody, you have to train kill somebody, and you have to shoot at people.
Well,
and,
just, I've talked about this a couple times, just hunting, and you've done this too, just cutting a deer up, shooting a deer and cutting a deer up, and having my hands, you know, elbow deep in gore, I kind of went, wow, I can see how easy it would be for a hunter to kill a human being a lot easier than it would be for somebody who's never done this.
Sure.
Just, you know.
Yeah, and also that you know, a hunter to be more comfortable in combat. And traditionally, you know, Audie Murphy and the sort of the World War II heroes and were hunters and did come from, you know, that kind of background. They're familiar with firearms, comfortable with firearms.
Well, not only that, what I didn't count on was the cold, was the gear, the heft of the gear on my back, the awkward nature of carrying a rifle because I kept getting caught on shit, falling down in cactus briar.
Yeah.
I had to pull cactus quills out of Joe Rogan's ass and legs because he freaked out and dove onto a cactus when he saw a buck. So, you know, we both got buck fever.
Yeah.
And you hunted elk too. You did a lot of the stuff.
I did the same thing. I mean, the elk, when I was hunting, I had the rifle on my back, and I'm like, you know, we're stalking these elk, and I snapped a branch, and Don Yeager looks at me like, okay, who brought the fucking new guy? You know what I mean?
Like, well, you said that's how they train, because you went and trained like a sniper. You did all these things. You went and trained. You broke into cars with gang members.
Right.
You did all this stuff to kind of to practice how to survive, how to steal a car, how to track and kill food, how to fight an assault weapon, a rifle in case you're in a combat situation. Talk a little bit about elk. I'm fucking nice. Idiot.
Wow.
Talk a little bit about elk hunting and why it's a similar skill set to actually tracking and killing a person.
Well, I mean, the thing about hunting elk, where I was doing it in Southern Colorado, is it's very active. You're not going in and sitting in a blind all day, which is more like deer hunting in the East Coast, or, you know, where it's flatter and the cover's denser. Because of the elk's incredible sense of smell, you can't be somewhere and getting your scent. You know, if you go into a blind and you sit there all day, your scent sort of spreads out over a whole area, and they just won't come there. So you have to sort of, and you can't predict where they're going to come out every time. They don't come out to the same places. So you sort of have to, at least according to Don Yeager and what I saw, was you sort of really had to, you know, basically run. Like, you had to hustle after them and stalk the last bit, but you had to really get there. And a lot of the territory's open, so you have to sort of pick your spots.
But deer, the elk can smell you from a really, what is that saying?
Well, the saying was, they'll hear you three times, see you twice, and smell you once. So if they hear you walking in the woods, they might not spook. If they see you at a distance and you freeze, and Don would call it playing the statue game, and then eventually you sneak off, you might get away with it. But if they smell you, if they catch any scent of you, they'll just take off and keep going.
Well, because we're meat eaters, so they probably smell
meat
eaters.
They smell terrible. Yeah, or something. But they're definitely, you know, very, very wary. And this part of the fun of hunting that animal, I think, is it's not a gimme. You know, it's not an easy thing to do, and it takes a lot of skill. And what I really love to get into is bow hunting, which, of course, you know,
you got
to
call them in for that time.
Well, that, and also you have to just get close. You have to be much better at stalking and go stalk a lot more.
When I was in Montana and we were freezing, and, you know, I was trying to sneak up on deer with a high-powered rifle with a Win-Mag 300, which, you know, I think the SEAL teams use, and you can shoot a deer from 300 yards or whatever. And I couldn't get near him, by the way. I finally, in early morning, I got my doe because she turned and stood for a while. But let me tell you, man, I was thinking to myself, I can't imagine being a Native American or, you know,
and
any kind
of
on foot and 20 yards,
20
with, a,
yards.
With a stone arrowhead and a bow. Nah, not going to happen. Not going to happen.
They did it, though. You know, it's amazing. Well, you know, it's interesting you talk about the stress factor and rising to your training. When I was hunting, I had taken 3 shots at 300 yards on a practice, you know, and that was the only time I'd ever shot at that range, and I had never shot farther. And with the rifle I was using, at, you know, 400-500 yards, you sort of had to start adjusting for the bullet dropping and stuff. So I took a shot at 300 yards and I made that shot perfect, but then the elk moved off and was still alive. I double lunged her, but that time I didn't know that, and I shot and missed clean because I you know, Don gave me the range, you know, 400 whatever yards, but
it's a long shot for
yeah. Well,
yards.
At that
that's
point,
a
you have
long
to aim,
shot.
You, now you're aiming at the very top of her back.
Wow,
because you've got a 6-inch drop at that. At
yeah,
that, and I just didn't compute it, so I took a perfect shot right into
and
her.
And it went under.
Went under. Missed clean.
Huh.
And she fell down at the exact same moment. But the thing was, you know, again, I hadn't trained it. I'd never done it before. And I definitely had, you know, a little bit of buck fever, a little conditioning.
Yeah.
Condition Red going on. You know, I was fumbling around, and I didn't know what I was doing. I was, you know, was my coming or going?
You get so eager. I had to just focus on everything but my trigger finger. I literally just kind of let go of everything, but I had to meditate about it the night before because the whole night, you know, because the night before I had a buck in my sights and I was panicking. The scope was jumping all over it. I was so excited.
Right.
You know, and I think that hunting's interesting because it teaches you how to look a different way and listen a different way.
Mm-hmm.
It just heightens your senses. We're so overloaded by stimulus in this society. Constantly overloaded by your phone, by traffic signals, people around you. When you're out in the open like that, it was very interesting. I had a very different experience. You know, you're so linear with your, you know, you're looking at this panorama, but you're looking for anything out of the ordinary, movement.
Well, also your sense of time. You know, you're doing it for hours and hours and hours. I have trouble reading a whole article on the internet. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I read the first paragraph, page. You know. And it's seconds. You're spending seconds on things.
Yeah, this guy Juan Enriquez on TED said, "Now the average person is exposed to more stimulus in one day than our ancestors were in a lifetime."
Right.
When you're living out in the sticks, nothing is moving. There's not a lot to do.
Yeah, slow.
Yeah, quiet, and it's just a different reality.
No, it's something like this. It's if the history of man was a book, 200 pages would be, you know, hunter gatherers living in very small groups, very very little, you know, any outside interaction. And then agrarian culture starts on the last page, and the last two centuries is a sentence of that book. So
that's a really cool
what you've evolved into, what you've evolved to be, is radically different than the life you lead. And I think that was an interesting realization. So, you know, all these fears that we have that seem, you know, fears of these apocalyptic fears in particular, they're hangovers from, you know, your primordial fears that you spent your whole evolutionary history dealing with. You know?
Well, you know, that brings me, because the book is written somewhat tongue-in-cheek. You're not a survivalist. You're not ready, getting ready for the apocalypse. We're not sitting on drums of lentils here, but you don't have an arsenal. You're far from a survivalist. But at the same time, when I read the book, I went, there's a lot of shit that nobody thinks disaster is going to strike when it does. And and when you're not ready, and almost everybody that you know, and including me, is not ready, even remotely ready. I mean, I am on the grid, man. I'm on the grid.
Yeah.
And part
of
being on the grid is just relying on, you were talking about how important communities are, because that's the best way to survive, a strong community.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, certainly, and I'm not the first guy to say that. I mean, the sort of the founding father of survivalism, this guy Mel Tappan, used to say that. But, you know, having a small community with a doctor and a mechanic and, you know, a farmer, obviously, like, it's great for me to learn a little bit about farming, but what would be better to have an Amish guy with you? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
A guy who's been in the 18th century.
Your army is an Amish guy, doctor with soft hands.
We laugh at those guys on reality TV now, but if the shit hits the fan, those guys are going to be sitting pretty because nothing changes for them. They got it all figured out, you know?
Well, I've often seriously thought about buying land and, you know, going out. Joe Rogan and I talk about it, and I need to be welcome. Go out there and let's just buy a big plot of land. And let's raise some geese and fucking ducks and some reindeer. And
well, I think the interesting kind of question, really, when you get into survivalism, and, you know, this book was about worrying about the apocalypse and the zombies and aliens, you know, is kind of walking that line of what's paranoia and what's preparation, what makes sense to do and what's smart and what's, you know, paranoid ridiculousness. And I think it's not clear. It's a gray area. You know, the example I always think of is a friend of mine whose grandparents got his parents out of Nazi Germany 2 weeks before they closed the border. 2 weeks. You know, and they walked away from their businesses and, you know, clients and everything they owned, and, you know, went somewhere they didn't speak the language. And it's like, could you recognize that? You know, could you?
Most people can't.
It's almost impossible.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could do it.
Well, because we are human beings are also programmed
to
be synthetically happy. I mean, you look on the bright side. It's a part of survival in some ways. The irony is part of your survival mechanism is to make the best of the situation and to think it's going to get better tomorrow. I can't get any worse than this.
Well, and that's always the joke about, you know, the Jews are seeing, you know, Kristallnacht and Hitler do all these things. Yeah, of course he's going to kill us.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. You know, it's so hard to upend everything.
In Schindler's List, when the guy gets, when the family gets put into this sort of
ghetto,
and she goes, you know, she says something like, you know, relax, whatever, Adam, it could be much worse. And
right.
He says, how could it be worse? How could it be any worse than this?
Right.
Well, guess what?
They find
they're
going
to kill everybody.
Yeah, you know
how it's going to be worse? They're going to kill 6 million.
It gets a lot worse. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, that kind of recognition, there's a dual kind of, I don't know, theme in this book to me, which was that, you know, yes, some of these fears are ridiculous. You know, zombies are ridiculous. Aliens is a ridiculous fear, obviously. But on the other hand, there is this huge vulnerability in modern life. We live in a city, and the population here is unsustainable without the grid. I mean, it's just... There's running water. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah.
That's a simple fact, and there's no argument about that. You know, this much land cannot support this population without refrigeration, electricity, you know, running water, sanitation, all these things. It would have a complete breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a real vulnerability, and I think that's what a lot of these preppers are hitting off, and they're reacting to that, and that's real.
Yeah.
But yet they you know, and they're easy to make fun of, and you know, Doomsday Preppers, I think, is a little bit in the vein of all reality TV, which is the look at these crazy people and ha ha ha. But there is a real fear there, and I think the challenge for us is, you know, is functioning in society without becoming, you know, ridiculous, and also being a man, because a man is responsible,
right.
A man is prepared,
right?
And you know, that's kind of
so. Give me some of the things that an average what should the average person do to get ready?
I think about Hurricane Sandy, right? You live in New York, and I was just talking to a guy and I botched this answer because I hadn't really thought it through enough, but you know think about just a camping trip, you know, with 10 things, it's a great time, you know. Without those 10 things, you die.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's just the case. So just, you know, think about it for a short survival stint first. I think, you know, it's like, because living in Southern California, if you're not ready for the big one and you live in Southern California, it's like driving without a seatbelt. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to
happen. The big one being an earthquake.
Yeah, the big one being, you know, an 8 or a 7-8 or an 8-2 or whatever.
Well, you had talked about, you know, water. Getting drums for clean water.
Well, listen, you know, water you should have, you know, it'd be nice if you had a gallon of water a day per person. You can get by with less, but it's not as nice.
A gallon a day per person.
Per person, and
okay.
That includes your kids and everything. And then...
Gee, that's... Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's a lot of water.
A lot of water.
And water, you know, is heavy, it takes up space, and you gotta change it, it goes stale, and it goes bad. You know, food...
Where can you get water containers?
You can get one on the internet. I mean, all this stuff, with $500 in 10 minutes on Amazon, you can get all this. That's,
wow.
That's the thing, really.
Okay. What about, so you need flashlights?
You need
a generator?
Yeah, lamps. You don't need a generator.
Okay.
I don't think a generator is, you know, listen, I grew up and I used to live in a house that didn't have any power. We had kerosene lamps. We had a privy, you know, at times. And so, you know, you don't need a generator.
So
everyone wants one. It's funny, my friend Nathan, who's a builder, he's like, whenever there's anything happens, I get calls from all my clients. They got to come in and put generators in. My dad has a generator on the Cape, and it kicks on once a year for 12 hours when the power goes out. You know what I mean? And it's this huge thing. It's automatic. But it's got a million moving parts in it, and it can easily break
down. Well, kerosene lamps are interesting.
I just think, you know, listen, you can get headlamps. You can get candles. You can have, you know, basic stuff, man. You know, and then, you know, you can get MREs, meals ready to eat. You can buy boxes of them online. You can get, you know, camping dried food. You can get cans of stew from Dintymore's. You know, it's not a big... Food is also the easiest one, because right now you could last, you know, 3 weeks off the fat stores in your body, especially you.
Yeah. Oh, I have no
You are a little...
No, dude, I'm shredded. I have a beautiful body.
No, but you could...
That's when you know you're in shape. When you would die within 3 hours... Because you're that
much. Certainly, you know, it is unhealthy to have too low a, you know,
yeah,
body fat index. Nobody
yeah
talks about it.
I fight at 145. So
well, 125.
Right, 125. If I wanted to compete in the UFC, I'd have to suck down from 170 to 125. Damn it! I'll never be a man!
The skeleton.
Ah, fuck.
Play skeleton.
But we do have in us, as men, a lot of men anyway, this residual memory. It's like this redundant, but we have this sort of need to be ready on some level. Guys take jiu-jitsu still. We lift weights.
Yeah.
I don't even know why I work out, but I know I got to be ready for something.
Yeah. No, I think definitely. And that's the other side of it, which is that self-reliance is fun, right? Self-reliance feels good. Self-reliance is a way to enjoy the world. Like hunting and being more self-reliant, you know, increases my understanding of the natural world.
Right.
Increases my understanding. You know, I've learned so much, so it's been a blast. And that's why I think the trick comes is, you know, preparation can be like an addiction, right? If it's making your life horrible and you're anxious and you can't sleep and you're building your bunker in the garage and you just don't want to talk to anybody, then it's hurting you. You know what I mean? And if it's making your life better, if you're meeting friends, you're learning new skills and you're outside getting a ton of fresh air and you're working out and you're in great shape, it's making your life better. Yeah. And that's kind of where I draw the line on it. You know what I mean? I think this is the minimum, which is, you know, be ready for a 2-month camping trip in your house.
A 2-month camping.
Whatever, you know what I mean? Like, if you can, you know, why not?
Yeah.
The Mormon religion, you have 2 years of food.
Jesus.
In the garage.
Really?
Yeah, Mitt Romney has 2 years of food in his garage.
I like that.
They rotate it, and they have a whole system. They have.
I guess I'll just drive to Salt Lake.
They're very prepared.
And have the Book of Mormon in my
hand. You can do it. Have you seen that play?
Hey, brothers, how you doing? Glad I'm a Mormon. Weren't you the guy on Mad TV? Nope, don't know that guy. I'm religious. I was praying in the tabernacle.
Where'd you do missions? Paris.
Paris. Yeah, I was in Paris. I drank a lot of wine. I love cheese. I was talking. We were hanging out with Mark Makita the other night, and I'm gonna get him on the podcast. Mark Makita is
a wonderful guy on the podcast.
Yeah, he's a really smart guy, but he's a world renowned expert at knife fighting, sounds like such an obsolete art form in some ways. It is, but you know, I was thinking that in 100 years ago. 200 years ago, he would have been very relevant.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
It's only in the last sentence of the book, as you say.
Mark uses it too as a, you know, in the broader sense, which is that mastery leads to the way, with a capital W.
Right. He's a true martial artist.
Yeah, which is...
Like, I offered him a drink. He goes, never had a drink in my life. I was like,
never had,
do you want some food? Yeah, he wants some food. He goes, no, I eat very, very clean. I was like, Jesus, what a Spartan.
He doesn't have sugar. He never has salt. I mean, he's the real deal. It was great. So I did study with him, and we did, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 months of a pretty intensive screamer work and stick work. And again, you know, he's a very interesting guy. But you realize, you know, cops will say that the knife is better than the gun, you know, and a lot of that has to do with what stress does to you and what, you know, we've talked about buck fever, but with a handgun and somebody breaking into your house or whatever, you know, handgun, a lot of it is fine motor skills and complicated manipulations. Particularly if something goes wrong, like you have a jam or a misfire, you need to clear it.
Survive.
Things get hard to do. So a knife, the cops always talk about the knife being better than the gun.
Meaning it's more deadly?
Because it doesn't jam. Yeah, it's more deadly a lot of the time. I mean, obviously you think, hey, I would rather have a gun in a fight, but that's really about range. If you don't have the range, and if you can't get the range, then the knife is better. So if we're this close, I mean, I'm 4 feet from Brian right now, then the knife is way better.
Yeah.
There was a great article that sort of started all this, was written by a Vegas cop called Dennis Tuller or something like that, but he wrote How Close Is Too Close in like 83. And he was studying, he was having guys basically run at cops with knives and seeing the distance that it would take for the cop to draw and get a shot off. And it was, I think they came up with 18 feet.
Wow.
So 18 feet or less, the guy gets to you and gets a good slash in.
And you get one good slash in, you lose hydraulics in 8 seconds. I mean,
yeah, I mean
Mark Makita was saying, you know, I could unzip you. In other words, if he could just open me up in my stomach and everything would spill out because you got so much abdominal pressure. Exactly what happened with the deer. I literally did a lazy swipe with a sharp knife, and that deer, who has thicker skin than I do by far, all that shit came out. And I thought to myself, I am a fucking balloon.
No, a surgeon friend of Mark's who's trained them a lot says, don't think about skin like a
piece of leather.
Think of it like unboiled egg, an uncooked egg.
Yeah, he said it's like hitting an egg yolk.
Yeah, it pops. It's egg yolk. It just spills out.
Jesus.
Which is gross. Yeah,
it's amazing how vulnerable we are to knives in that sense. Well, which, by the way, changes fighting. I mean, you know, he was saying, Mark said, give me a 110-pound girl, and I'll teach her how to slice up the baddest guy in the UFC you can find, because you cannot do anything against a knife. I mean, you can do things, but it's amazing how it changes the whole fucking game.
It certainly
game.
Does. I mean, still, it's a complicated question, and there's certainly guys that would, you know, ruin your life if you have a knife or not. They'll take it away from you. And
well, that's why I carry a sword, and then that makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I have a couple of swords around for defending the home.
A sword or a machete?
Machete.
Well,
you know, also, you know, you think about, like, coming home late at night and, you know, your wife shoots you by accident because she thinks you're a guy breaking in. If she has a sword, you know, she probably won't accidentally stab you to death.
She raises it.
She gets close enough.
She swings, I duck. And I bring her into a bear hug and say, shh, easy.
Easy. Easy like a wild
It's style. Daddy. Daddy's home. And that okay, is a sword. Sorry. So talk a little bit about the things you did in the Disaster Diaries to get ready. What are the things you actually did? You worked with gang members?
So, yeah, I kind of just broke down a lot of, you know, disaster tropes or sort of popular disaster movie ideas and, you know, looked at what the skills would be. So, yeah, every disaster movie, they're always, you know, the Terminator movies, they're always stealing cars all the time. So I went and talked to a bunch of ex-gangbangers about, you know, how they steal cars and also urban survival, how they used to survive in the streets of L.A. And I thought that would be a little more fun than just doing, all straight-up survival stuff, which I did plenty of that, too. I worked with John McPherson, who trains, SEER instructors, and Cody Lundeen, who's on that show, Dual Survivor. And he's great, by the way. I think Cody's...
Is that the guy who talks like this? He's with his wife?
No, the Dual Survival is Cody's barefoot, the big, huge...
Oh, that dude's a stud. Yeah, he's a big guy. He's a huge guy.
He's huge. And he was
a lot of protein to take him as a survivalist. Yeah, was he in prison?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Because he was there was all this like hard stuff coming up. Anyway, it's in the book, but it was a funny.
I remember when you guys were out there in the.
Because he's like got this real hard quality to him, but yet he's this giant hippie with like Dutch boy braids, and you're like, what's this guy's deal? But he is like a survival savant. I mean, he just knows so much, and he's got such a great scientific take.
It's still one of the things I gathered from your book. Because you went and lived with a guy who can live off a deer for a winter and stuff, and the guy who makes his own jerky and stuff, and a true survivalist who actually tans his own skin with the brains, you know, the oil from the brains, and does it the traditional Native American way. And but he said, you're not getting through the winter without help.
I mean, yeah, John was really interesting because he's a guy who has done all this, and he sort of... You know, he says these guys, these survivalists who go out there in the last year or whatever, he goes, you know, it's I don't really believe it a lot of the time. And, you know, you can go out for a month or two and that's nothing. Because, again, like, you're going to last pretty well off the fast forward you've got. You're not going to die.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you get a little bit of food in that time. And he was saying, we were out there in Kansas in July. He said, if we were out together, you and I were out in the wilderness together, we'd be hard-pressed to get together enough clothing just in time, you know, to survive the winter.
Just clothing.
Killing deer and tanning skins and
well, it's so
catching
cold.
Enough and then, yeah, so... And putting in stores...
Well, what did the Native Americans do? I mean, how many... You wear a deer pelt?
First of all, they were way tougher than you. Because they spend all their time outside. You grew up outside. You're acclimated to it. You know, you're not. It's almost impossible for modern man to understand how soft he is.
Yeah. You lived with the Inuit for a while.
And even those guys, you know, they're on snowmobiles now and stuff. But they, you know, they don't wear goggles all day long.
Yeah, you said that their hands and feet don't get cold.
Yeah, they have a much higher
tolerance,
basal metabolic rate. They were just hotter. They weren't hotter.
They run hard.
BMR is higher. Yeah, don't try to keep... Like the guide was like, don't try to keep up with the locals. Don't do it, because you can't do it.
You mean as in like, they just don't get cold?
They don't get cold. Yeah.
God damn.
No, I mean, I did a two-hour...
I'm such a bitch with the cold. I really am.
Oh, yeah, it's hell, dude. I worked in Antarctica, and I'll never be... You know, I can't handle it. One of the big cities.
Yeah, what did you do in Antarctica?
So I did construction.
In Antarctica?
At the South Pole, yeah.
Oh, my God. Keep it. Keep that all day.
The thing to remember, I think, in extreme cold, and this might be part of your problem, because you eat like a bird, is you're not eating enough. Whenever you get cold, it's almost always because you haven't eaten.
Really?
And the minute it happens, you need to start eating. And the best way to avoid hypothermia is internally, is food. And I have noticed, even when I was up in northern Canada in Pervertitook with these Inuit guys, and, you know, out in the snowmobile all day long, and, you know, after a couple hours, it didn't matter what you were wearing, you start to get chilled, and it's because you're hungry, and it's because you're I'm losing weight the whole time.
Sure.
So that could be actually a big part of your problem, is you're just not eating enough in the winter.
Right. That's probably exactly.
You know, you're living on your, because you're watching your girlish figure, because you're an actor. And
that's
you're
right.
You make your money through your hips and your face.
And my hips and my face. My hips and my face are my bread and butter. So I may rather be cold than have great hips and face.
But yeah, anyway, it's certainly true that, like, you need, if it's cold, you need to stay on top of your caloric intake, and if you sleep on it, you'll pay for it.
But you're talking about Native Americans who are primarily carnivores, so they live basically on meat.
Well, the Inuit are not all Native Americans, of course.
A lot of them were, though, weren't they? They berries and pine nuts.
The Inuit are pretty much all hunter, no gatherer. But I think, you know, other Native American tribes, certainly in the southern states, were more hunter gatherer. But
But I'm just, no, what I'm asking you is
these
this.
People are accustomed, they grew up outside, totally accustomed to it, and then, you know, they probably stayed inside a lot of the cold winter.
And they probably wore rabbit pelts and that kind of stuff.
No, listen, you can tan enough skins, you can make warm stuff. And, you know, it's not waterproof. You have all those problems.
Yeah, that is an issue, too.
Yeah, we have these magical, you know, fabrics now. That
rubber, nylon, well,
yeah,
light
wicking,
shit.
They're wicking, and they're light, and they stay warm when they're wet, and, you know, it's...
Well, one of the things they told me in the cold is never, no cotton against skin. Cotton kills.
Cotton's a death fabric.
Yeah, because when you sweat and then it freezes, you are fucked. Whereas merino wool, for example,
wool's good.
Because it'll wick away the moisture.
Wool just stays warm. Uh-huh. Wool doesn't wick, but it'll stay warm. It'll retain heat.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean that's staying dry in the cold is another huge thing. We used to say in Antarctica, they used to say, change your socks, change your whole day. You know what I mean?
Change your whole attitude.
Because you wear these bunny boots, those big white boots that have the little valve on the side that are just all...
I don't wear bunny boots, but yeah. Oh, okay, so you have a valve on the side?
Well, they're pressurized, and so if you fly, you have to open this valve because there's like little chambers inside them and stuff. They give them to you, they're issued.
So when you're in cold like that, what kind of clothing are you wearing?
Well, even, you know, I have to wear, for instance, when I went up, I had to buy my own boots for the second trip, and I bought Sorrel minus 100 degree boots.
Sorrel minus 100?
Well, and they're basically like platform shoes. You know, you just have about 2 inches of stuff to keep you off the... Because you're losing most of your heat through conduction in that sense. So there's three ways to lose heat: convection, radiation, conduction.
Okay.
And, you know, radiation, you put a hat on, and convection's the wind, so you have your wind, you know, your big parka and all that stuff, and then conduction is when you're sitting on a cold rock or...
So the soles of the shoes are what's really important.
Yeah, it can be in real cold, you know.
And what is a layer around your toes and stuff? Is it all nylon?
Well, you don't want to be too... Yeah, I mean, you don't want to reduce...
Circulation.
So that's... And then, yeah, you don't want...
What kind of a jacket are you wearing? Are you wearing a jumpsuit?
No. I had... actually, thank God this guy lent me his real parker, because I kind of was like being a cheapskate. And I'm like, oh, I'm just gonna... I had like a down thing and this, and I had some pieces, and it was not going to do it.
You can't do it.
Well, you know, a real, you know, high-end Arctic down parker is, you know, $700 or whatever.
Wow.
But you got to have it. It's got the huge hood with fur and all.
You need all that shit.
Yeah, you know, and I wore liner and glove liners, and then I wore big snowboarding gloves, and then over them all I had these awesome wolfskin mitts.
Well, dude, that was so amazing. I saw those wolfskin
mitts. Yeah, you seen the pictures.
Mitts.
Yeah, I wish I had a picture.
They're giant, and they weren't cured. When you live in the Arctic like that,
you can
just let them lie. They can let them sit out there.
No, it's amazing to realize those guys live in a giant freezer. They call them... The word Eskimo means people who eat raw meat. That's what the Indians called them. Mm. So when the Indians introduced them to the Europeans, they called them the Eskimo. And that means those who eat raw meat. But they, of course, call themselves the Inuit.
Well, talk a little bit about the fact that, you know, if they didn't kill a deer that winter, they lived in the dark and had to live on raw fish.
The igloo, they heat it with this little fatty lamp that has a wick in it. Forget the exact name, but anyway, it's all run on seal oil. So if they missed a seal, or sometimes they missed it, it meant you weren't cooking anything or having any light or heat in your igloo for the entire winter, and yet you could live. Because again, what's the most important thing is what is the chemical heat inside you, right?
What a fucking bore.
Can you imagine?
In the fucking, where it's dark 24/7, it's a part of the year up there.
No.
You're living in the dark.
It was mind-blowing that two of these guys that I was talking to, and they're young guys, they're, you know, 55 or something like that, 60. They're not old. Born in an igloo, you know what I mean? And it was just crazy to be like, this guy, motherfucker, was born in an igloo.
And an igloo.
Like, how different... And he's like, oh yeah, I had a little... He goes, when I was a little kid, you know, we'd spend the winter in the igloo, and I had a little bow with an arrow. That was my toy for the winter. And you think, I look at my 4-year-old and the toys in his room.
I mean, it's such a different... First of all, here's a question. Why the fuck didn't they keep walking south? I mean, I would not have been... I would have been like, you guys want to live here and never see a tree? Keep it. I'm walking south, first of all. So already it's a different mindset, you know, whoever decided to stay there. Secondly, let's not forget the fact that they were dealing with a little something called polar bears. Strictly meat eaters, and they'll eat a human as fast as they'll eat a fucking seal, from what I understand.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know how you survive in an area like that where you've got 1,700-pound dog monsters that want to eat you.
Well, that was, I mean, I think that was an interesting sort of thing to get into, was that the, for them, sled dogs was a big part of their, you know, it was a huge part of their survival tool. And so I did a little sled dogging stuff up there, and, you know, I tried to learn. I was only up there for a couple of weeks, so I didn't really have a chance to get into it, you know. Normally, I would go up there for 6 months and, you know, apprentice to a sled dog guy, but I didn't get to do that for this book. But, yeah, I mean, there's even a word, and again, I've forgotten all this stuff, but the real useful element in the Inuit culture is the man and his dog sled team and his sled. Like, that's a one thing. And when they're broken up, none of them are that useful. You know what I mean? So it's like, if you know, having these dogs was, you know, not just for the transportation, but for the protection from polar bears.
Because dogs are, and bears are natural enemies.
Yeah, and they're just
gonna, so the dogs are going to keep the bear at bay?
15 bear, you know, 15 dogs, yeah, they probably would. You know, yeah. One bear, they might. You know, they'd fight them, you know, and they would get after it. You know, these dogs are not pets. You know, they're very dangerous.
They are?
Well, not very dangerous, but...
They'll bite you.
Yeah.
You're feral animals.
You don't go down and pet them.
You don't
go down on the level and cuddle with them. No, they don't come in the house. They're not... Yeah.
They're a special breed. They're not huskies.
What they call Greenland Husky, which is a much different animal than almost anything else.
Because any other animal, any other dog in that climate will die, including Huskies, right?
Yeah, Huskies are way too soft. It's crazy, dude. I mean, we were out there, and I got to tell you, it was 35, 40 below, blowing probably 20 knots, 15 knots, and...
Fuck that.
Ice, not snow. Not so you can burrow a little hole in ice.
Just ice.
The dog just rolls up in a ball, puts his tail over his nose, and goes to sleep.
What?
In a line.
The ice?
Yeah, tied up in a chain on the line.
On the ice?
They got two or three frozen fish, frozen solid, and a half a stick of lard each.
A half a stick of lard and
three there frozen you go. Fish. And they're curling up.
If my dog ever fucking barks at the door again, I'm going to be like, hey...
You know what it could be?
You want some fucking raw frozen fish?
If I would. Lucy would love
that. That's so weird, man.
Yeah, no, they're so tough. I was like, those dogs are going to die. They're like, no, they're good dogs. They like the cold. They like the cold. Yeah, and it turns out there's...
Curling up on the ice and going to sleep.
Yeah, they're one of the primitive. So there's like seven primitive dogs in the world.
Yeah.
And they're one of them, the Greenland Husky.
Huh.
Yeah, they're crazy.
How much do they weigh?
They're not that big. They're decent size. They were much bigger. What, so the Inuit,
60 pounds? Or?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Maybe even less. 55, 60, yeah. 45. Yeah, no, they're probably bigger than that.
Strong animals.
Oh, my God, yeah. No, they're real deal. I mean, they're a step down from a wolf. You know, Jesus. I mean, they're rough and tough.
And are there wolves out there where you are?
No.
No Arctic wolves?
No, it's too far north. That I know of. There might have been some. They have
what a hardy animal, and the polar bear. I mean,
they have polar bears. Yeah,
being able to survive that is ridiculous for the polar bear. Because like, there's huge winter kills with deer in Montana. It's just so cold they all die.
Yeah,
which I didn't know.
Yeah, so
the fact is even animals die in the cold.
Oh yeah, no, and that's why you should really, when you go hunting, you should kill calves, baby animals.
Why? Because they're gonna die.
A lot of them won't make it through the winter.
Yeah. Huh.
So you're
and you tell me that they
and that meat's just out there rotting now. You know
right.
What I mean? So. You're filling your meat. You know, it's hard to do that in your head.
Yeah.
But a lot of the, you know, the real long-term hunters will...
Especially if you can eat it raw. I mean, that's the other thing I was thinking about. They don't build fires.
Right? No, well, they do now. I mean, yeah, they have little Coleman stoves everywhere.
Sure, but in, traditionally...
They would
have
how
do they stay warm?
They have this lamp.
They
had this I forget the name of it.
Oh, so you get to warm yourself by a candle.
Yeah.
That's
well, if you warm up the igloo too much, it'll start to melt and it's a problem. So the igloo can't get too warm. If you can't
see the igloos themselves.
If you can't see your breath in the igloo, it's too warm.
Wow.
So that's what you're living in for the winter. In the dark.
Dude,
you know, under the blanket.
How do you have sex, I guess, under a blanket?
What do you mean?
I mean, you get naked.
What else are you gonna
do? You get naked eventually.
I mean, I guess. Or so, you get enough naked.
You're not taking a shower, really, ever.
No.
How do you clean your a-hole?
I mean, you probably rub it with snow. It's nice and clean.
Yeah, you rub your ass with snow.
Yeah, it cleans it right out.
Nice and clean, and clean you out. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can, you know.
I guess before you make your love, you suck some whale blubber. There's no mince, and then you rub your asshole on the snow like a baboon, and then you get busy.
Sounds hot, right?
You can keep all that shit.
Well, it's in the dark. You can't see anything anyways. So
fuck that. Fuck all of it.
I got to make an igloo, and I spent the night in an igloo just for the hell of it.
You told me that you said, you know, what happens, I mean, you, do you starve to death sometimes? They're like, oh yeah, we starve to death all the time.
People. Yeah. No, this guy who was born in the city, who I spent so much time with, this guy, Acme, he told me a story where his mother was at a camp with, and the men were off on a month-long seal hunting trip. And everybody was at starvation level, right? And his mother and a few of the women were left with the kids. And they were trying to catch fish in this lake, couldn't catch fish. And they had one old dog, and they had to kill this dog. And they didn't have a gun, so they got a rope around its neck, and it took them all day to kill this effing dog.
God
damn. But basically, if they didn't kill that dog, then he wouldn't be talking to
them. Oh, and then they had to eat the dog raw.
They might have cooked it. They might have had fire. But again, they... You know, if they hadn't eaten that dog, I mean, that's like if your dad was telling you a story about if he didn't eat a dog, he was going to be dead. I mean, like,
it's like my dad would tell me a story about the Marines and how it was really tough in boot camp, but
it's just like very different. You know, these guys are so connected to real death from starvation that now it's very hard because they have snowmobiles, they have rifles, they have all the modern technology, and the Inuit can hunt whatever they want. They don't need permits. They don't need any kind of... So they people get a little... I think people from the warmer places in the south get this kind of idea that the Inuit just kill everything. And they kill a lot of stuff, but it goes into a food bank and it feeds the elderly and stuff. And you understand
what was the story
why
I heard?
Do that, you know, because it's just the starvation is part of their lives.
I heard a story about the very old, they'll leave on an iceberg and just let die. Is that true?
Well, I think listen, if everybody's, if we're in a little group of 10 people and we're
being held back,
just about to die, all of us, and we don't have enough food for Granny.
Yeah.
Nobody can carry her.
Yeah.
And, it's going to kill the dogs to carry her. Then we leave her, and that is a long time ago. That was more like, 200, 400 years ago.
So harsh.
But again, Acme told me this great story about, this is in the 1600s or whatever. And, the family, they had to leave the old woman behind. So they leave, and she's in her 70s or whatever. And they leave her, and she's got her, her walking stick and her big mitts. And, she doesn't want to die, so she starts following the sled tracks. They're gone a couple days. And she's walking along the sled tracks, and she comes to a polar bear.
Oh, my God.
And she puts her stick down the polar bear's mouth and then shoves her mittens in the polar bear's mouth as it's trying to eat her and kills it. And then she walks down the track, comes into camp 3 days later, and he was laughing because he's like, yeah, they had to keep her because she knew where the meat was. So the whole family lived. They had to go back and get that polar bear.
Jesus.
And that was the, he found that hilarious. He thought it was like the
kill
story.
The fucking polar bear.
Yeah, I mean, who knows if it's true or not, but it was very... much like one of his kind of, cultural
stories.
The
polar bear must have been like, I can't believe I just fucking...
God damn it.
Right in my mouth.
So, what is that?
That's so wild. Let me just thrust it into his...
Yeah, you never know. I mean, listen, old ladies are tough. You know what I mean? And
well, especially if you're trying to survive.
Yeah, and certainly if you've been up there your whole life, and polar bear might have been real weak from hunger. So
yeah, and they grabbed her and just followed her. What a hard... So you lived with the Inuit... You went and lived with various survival guys and, learned how to tan hides and make jerky and things like that and trap small animals with different various traps. You broke into cars with gang members, former gang members who taught you how to steal a car in an emergency. And I'm trying to think of what else I read you did. What's interesting is that about training with weapons, with guns. And, you trained with AR-15s. I know they have a lot of notoriety, and it's very, notorious gun now with the tragedy in Connecticut. But you trained with AR-15s. I remember you saying that a handgun is really not good for combat. You miss. It's not accurate. Whereas an AR-15 is very, very effective.
Yeah. Well, it's just a civilian version of what the military carried today.
It's an M16.
Yeah, M4 or whatever. But, yeah.
M4 is a modified M16. It's just a shorter barrel and a shorter stock, I think.
So the saying is that the pistol is what you fight your way to the rifle with. You want the if you're going to be in a fight, you want a rifle. That was what the people told me, and I think that's what sort of the gist of what I got from talking to these military guys and stuff. And it's certainly true that I understand the appeal of the AR-15 because if you're going to be shooting and fighting, that's what you'd want. And it's funny,
Well, you said to me also that the survival rate, I think, for a handgun can be 80%.
Right.
And whereas a rifle, the velocity of the bullet is so fast, it's 10% or 15%. Yeah. because the velocity is so incredible.
Yeah, no, it's twice as fast, and sometimes a smaller bullet, but twice as fast. Yeah, so anyway, there's a lot of, you know, and listen, there's a lot of jargon here and a lot of experts, and every gun store clerk is going to tell you something different, and, you know, it's, you have to kind of go with your own experience and people you talk to. I worked with Tiger McKee in Alabama, who's, you know, one of the premier firearms instructors in the country, but you know, there's a lot of good firearms.
What surprised you about shooting?
It was surprisingly physical. Much more physical than you think, because it's not shooting, it's fighting. You know what I mean? So it's footwork, you know, you have to, it's exhausting stance, movement, communication, you know, not only with people around you, but with the target.
Being aware.
Well, you're communicating, you know, drop the weapon, drop the gun, get out of my house, whatever. You know, that screaming, that stuff is really tiring, you know what I mean? And you have to do it. And it was just it was extraordinarily hot. It was in Alabama. And
did you train shooting out of a car, shooting out of a house?
Yeah, I shot in, you know, all out of getting in and out of my car and around all kinds of cover, even nighttime stuff. And a lot
what
of
does it cost to learn to take something with him for a week?
I don't know what it is for a week. I worked at a deal with him, but there's a bunch of academies. There's Thunder Ranch, there's Gunsight, there's a couple in Vegas that are big chains now that like do a lot.
How many of these guys that you worked with had read your book, Fighter's Heart or Fighter's Mind?
Oh, some of them had.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I gave it to him. I mean, Tiger was aware of it, for sure. Tiger was a martial artist and was he was into Tai Chi and thought it had done a lot for his shooting. So interesting. Yeah.
Well, when Joe Rogan was he's an excellent pool player. Phenomenal pool player.
Like he could go pro. Right?
Yeah. And when he was shooting, we were sighting our rifles and they wanted to see how well we shot, he said, took him like a couple times to adjust, and then he was hitting the target, you know, right on sight. And he said it's a lot like pool. Mm-hmm. Breathing is similar. You hold the gun versus, you know, you don't squeeze it. There's an alert relaxation to everything.
Yeah, no, and certainly I think, you know, pulling the, if firing gun is athletic, and it's you know, the way I try to describe it is, you know, it's all you got to do is you got to pull the trigger and hold the tube steady.
Yeah,
and the bullet goes where you want. But by initiating the action, by pulling the trigger, you jostle a tube. So those are the two things you're working with. Is trying to make that as gentle a press as possible. And they always say the trigger should surprise you. The gun should surprise you when it goes off.
Right.
In terms, not that you're surprised, but that you're not thinking about the bang.
Sure.
And certainly the flinch, you know, is the natural reaction to the firearm, and it's the tendency you fight your whole life. And it's, you know,
there's a former Delta Force sniper that I got to know who's in Seattle, and I'm going to do stand-up. By the way, you're doing stand-up in Seattle February 7th through the 9th at Parlor Live for you guys who want to come. And I'll be at Governor's Comedy Club in Levittown, Long Island, February 22nd and 23rd. I can't wait. But I hope to go up shooting with him. He was a Delta Force sniper, and I would love to. Those guys are
it's a whole different deal.
It'd be really interesting to take.
It's about stillness. It's about doing bone on bone for those. You know, from what I know about sniper,
what is bone on bone?
Well, you know, you're resting nothing on muscle, right? So everything's resting. You know, all your rests. It's like when you're shooting prone, lying down.
Yeah,
that's your most accurate because everything is touching the ground.
Yes.
And as soon as you start to come up, you know, it's
very difficult.
It becomes much harder. Yeah.
And I shot my deer lying down, I believe. I can't remember.
And if you can get a rest, you know, hold on to something, it makes a huge difference. I mean, I'm not a good shot, but shooting with the AR, you know, I think it was about 100 yards. Tiger had this whole wall of, like, you know, it was a roof and then a chain link fence and things to crawl under and shoot and stand over and shoot around. So you got, you know, sort of a feel for all kinds of terrain. And whenever you could grab something and make it part of your rest, it was so easy to get hits. When you're just standing
you're all over the place.
Around,
don't those guys who really know guns say the best way to avoid getting shot is just stand still?
Yeah, that was his joke.
Yeah.
I said, Tiger, what would you do if somebody pulled a gun on you? He goes, well, I'll just stand still.
Because people always
they're gonna miss. Yeah, and that's, I mean, the crazy thing is that even cops, you know, they have this shooting house, and Tiger was saying on one side, they come in, and one of the first things they have to do is draw, make their presentation, and shoot this target. And he says, this target's one thing, but behind it, there's a 4-foot by 4-foot bullet trap. And he says, guys are missing it from 10 feet.
Wow.
They're missing the bullet trap.
Wow.
Like, they're going, so they're so amped up. They're coming around a corner and they're bang, you know, and they're lucky they're not shooting their foot off.
That's right.
Or shooting, you know, up in the air or whatever. And it's like 80%.
And these are cops.
These are cops.
Yeah.
Who, you know, they don't get to train a lot. I mean, SWAT team guys train every day, and they're great, and they get very good. But
you tell me that, you know, there are stories about
they get paid to train two days a year.
Cops would be shooting on a firing range, slinging a bunch of lead down range, and then their brass would hit the ground. They'd pick it up, put it in their pocket.
Yeah, that was an FBI thing. Yeah.
And the problem was they were finding agents who were dead with a bunch of brass in their pockets because they were resorting to their
during
even
the
in a fight. They were resorting to their training.
Yeah.
Or the guys that they practice taking a gun away from each other.
Yeah.
And you hand the gun back, and he tries it, and you try it, and you try it. And then the guy took the gun away from the robber and handed it back to him.
Yeah.
His partner had to shoot him.
Yeah, that's a crazy story from On Combat, which is a great book. But
that's a great book. On Combat and On Killing are very good books.
There's a lot of great books. I mean, Extreme Fear is a wonderful book. The Science of Fear, this guy Daniel Gardner, I'm rereading it. It's a wonderful book.
But you read these books, you wrote this book, you've read all these books. You don't carry a gun. You don't really carry a knife. You don't really, you know, but you don't. It hasn't changed really your behavior. Is that because you live in a nice part of Los Angeles?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I had a hilarious experience. I was walking down the street with, I had like some funny Second Amendment shirt, and some lady's like, I want a gun because they're all dangerous. And I was like, do you have any idea where you are? There's not a dangerous person in like a 5-mile radius.
Yeah, yeah.
I live in Santa Monica. But
then again,
listen, no,
I never know, right?
I haven't gone in the house, and you know, I do. Practice getting up in the night and getting out of the safe. You have a safe, right?
I have a safe, yeah.
Yeah. How often do you get into it?
I don't do it enough.
You know what? I woke up the other morning and I was like, you know what? I want to see if I can get in right now. And I couldn't get in.
Yeah, well, that's
five tries, I couldn't do it.
That's a problem.
I had to come back. I came back after I had a cup of coffee and got in.
Well, my feeling is almost if you're going to have it in your house, you're doing it because somebody's going to come in your house in the middle of the night. I want that gun. That gun should be in a holster, loaded and ready.
No, right? But see, that's the thing. That's the danger is, you know, the real statistics, you know, which the CDC, you know, those kind of numbers, if you have a gun in the house, you're much more likely to get shot by it.
Yeah.
By your own gun. You know, by your
that's
wife,
the Center for
by your kids.
Control. But I always make a joke. It's not going to happen to me, dude. I'm way too cool under pressure. And I've been rehearsing that moment my whole fucking life.
No, I think, you know, listen, it's definitely not a gimme. And there's not a set answer. I do think, you know, I think Second Amendment and I believe that people who are responsible should have firearms and, you know, God bless them and it's great. But I also think part of being responsible is training with it, and part of training with it is, you know, taking a real course with a real firearms guy and going through a 4-day intensive handgun course, because without it, you ain't worth shit.
Well, we'll close on this point, and that is funny, is because there's such a difference in theory and practice. And when we all have a notion of what we would do in an emergency, we all have an idea of what we think we'd do in an apocalypse. We all have an idea of what we think we'd do in a situation, an emergency, whatever it might be. And then what happens is when you actually go into the training of it, there are so many factors you didn't take into account.
Yeah,
the heft of the gun, the noise, how clumsy it is, where you are, your footing is huge,
yeah,
all those things.
Think of this thing,
your breathing, a thousand things. The fear is going to happen, your tunnel vision that happens, what happens to your brain. And unless you train for those things, it's a good metaphor for life. I mean, one of the things I talk about is I went hunting and you and I always talk about, you know, I'm a libertarian, I always say, but I have to say, after hunting and being in Montana and seeing how vigilant and effective the Fish and Game Service is, it changed my political point of view a little bit, where I went, you know, sometimes you need some fucking regulation in life, because otherwise guys will shoot everything out there.
They'll
be blasting and I don't care what anybody says, they're assholes. Guys will take machine guns and shoot everything.
They're not trained.
Right.
They're amped up.
They're
freaking
up.
Out.
Yeah.
And they're going to be blasting at anything.
And guys get drunk and they go out
and
shoot a bunch of shit, you know?
It doesn't happen anymore.
Right.
And it's
you know why it doesn't happen? It's because the Fish and Game Service will confiscate your fucking car.
Yeah.
And sometimes
I think drinking has changed and hunting has changed too. And, you know, and people have gotten a lot more responsible about, you know, and better at it.
Yeah.
But it's not.
So I'm not a total anarchist. I'm not a total libertarian. I guess that's the bottom line.
I'm an anarchist.
Well, Sam Sheridan, always a pleasure. One of my dear friends and somebody who lives 4 blocks away from me. So
so we'll be the bandit together when the zombie apocalypse hits. It's
that's
and
it.
Brian.
And guys, get the Disaster Diaries. You can get it on Audible. You can get it on your Kindle. You can get it in hard copy. I've got 2 hard copies. And it's a great book. It's such a fun read. And it's impossible. Everybody I know who's read it changes something about their life. I mean, they're getting ready. They're either taking a gun course, a knife course, a survival course.
Wife, your wife's really into it.
She's crazy about it. She wants to buy jugs of water. I've always been this way. I've always believed in that.
There's a minimum that you should do. I just think, you know, being a man, being a person, is a minimum of responsibility you have to take.
Yeah.
And not to take it. It's on you, man. It's
well,
on
if
you.
You don't take it, you're at the mercy of other people and their generosity, right?
Yeah, don't be a refugee.
Right, don't be a refugee. And we'll leave it at that. Don't be a refugee. That you heard it first and last from Sam Sheridan. This is Brian Callen. This is The Brian Callen Show, the podcast, once again, where you learn fucking everything.
Nice.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/BrianCallenComedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. 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 See you next time.